me for this presentation. Many of you are young here and have been born already after the genomic revelation. But I'm going to give my perspective of how that hits the life of somebody that after that. Deborah said, in this last 20 some years, I've been working with trying to know the magic potion that there is in the saliva of blood-sucking arthropods in general. I mean, including mosquitoes and ticks in particular, has been part of my interest. And what we learned is that when ticks are feeding, you know, they create a tissue injury, and then there is all the hemostasis with platelet aggregation, vessel contraction, edema, and then later on you have, you know, the immune functions. And where you see each of these little tick here are molecules that we identified that block one of these pathways. Actually, you could populate this with more little ticks because this figure was done some years back. And each animal that evolved to the blood feeding mode, they evolved completely different protein families to deal with this. But in the beginning, in the last 7 years, we are hit by the so-called proteomic or genomic revolution. The mode we used to operate was the very old grind and find method. You know, we had an attitude that we know what saliva is, so we had a pre-existing hypothesis. You know, it prevents platelet aggregation or it prevents hemostasis, so there must be an anti-clotting there. And then you guess a bioassay, test, homogenate, purify the activity, obtain fragments and peptidic fragments, and then you would obtain the primary sequence by fishing the cDNA by PCR. Now we have no idea what saliva is, and we mass sequence the cDNA library and guess the function of the interesting cDNAs and test to activity and express or not the DNA, it's a completely different ballgame. This part here is very well known, defined methodology. You know, it's hypothesis-driven research and so on. But this one here tends to be interpreted as a fishing expedition. So what are we doing there? Actually, NIH has a word to define that type of research that is basically discovery-driven. So that's the new system. And to tell you, and not only the transcriptomes that hit, but I was hit by the Anopheles gambia genome, and then by the Aedes aegypti genome, the Culex genome. So my perplexity on this, imagine that you are a physicist, and then you want to know all the laws, you know, all the equations of physics that describe the interactions of the particles that could, you know, like string theory try to do, but it's always missing something. You don't know how many more equations you have to do. It's completely unknown from that point. And imagine, and then I am not in Utah, but the people from Utah would understand this. Imagine that suddenly a flying saucer would come to me and bring, you know, a book on leaves of gold, and then they'll tell all the equations that you need to know, they are here. And then the first thing that I would know, oh, there is a limit, because the book has a limit, so it must be, you know, 100 megabytes of information there. And you cannot read the book completely. There is some things that you know, you understand the F equals MA there, but then there are other equations you don't know. The point is, what do you do? You know, do you try to decode the book or continue life as usual? That's what I've been thorn these days, because you know, I want to go to the book, and I have all the genome of Anopheles gambia, but then how can I read that? And the hypothesis-driven research that I was done before, I could trace to the Enlightenment or Francis Bacon new organon. But what is this new ball game? So where does it come from? Well, from my reading, I could trace it back to a rabbi that was Moisés Maimonides, and you see he was from 1135 to 1205, and then he wrote the Guide for the Perplexed. And basically, the Guide for the Perplexed, it's interesting, maybe if you can, why You know, and 40 years later, actually, St. Thomas of Aquinas did the same thing for the Christians by bringing Aristotle thoughts into the church, and that was what created the Renaissance. But then you can ask, but why this wasn't done before? Well, in the year 400, when Saint Augustine wrote the City of God, and if you read that, you see that is the Taliban. You know, it's, life is too short. All you have to do here is to sustain your body and think about your salvation. Everything else, studying physics, throw it away. And in the year 550, you know, Justinian closed the Academy of Plato. And when he closed the Academy of Plato, where do you think that the philosophers went? To King Koros in Persia. And then 100 years later, Islamic people took over, but they kept the philosophers, did not send them back to the Roman Empire. And then in that period of time, you had many great philosophers like Al-Farabi and to begin with, and then to the end, like Averroes, that was already a contemporary of Maimonides. They translated everything from Greek to Arabic, and they made great commentaries, and including great advances in medicine, because they used the physics of Aristotle, and that's why physicians are called, because it's traced to the book of Aristotle, and they created their universities for teaching medicine and understanding nature, and that made, during the Crusades, they made the Catholic priests and even the Jewish rabbis to look very stupid when they were confronting a religious discussion with the mullahs, the Islamic clerics. And then they learned this because the Islamic clerics were all using, you know, Aristotle thought to justify their thoughts, and that's exactly what Moses Maimonides brought, and then St. Thomas brought, and that in that, I come back to the point that I came, that truth may be obtained by interpreting the prophet's revelations and by observation of nature in the use of logic. But the use of Aristotelic thought and logic was used to interpret the revelations, which was like the books, the sacred books. So that was the idea. And to me, this concept of revelation is exactly what comes to me when a genome comes to me. It's not revelation. So what do you do in order to study revelations? It has nothing to do with the Baconian approach. Well, this initial approach that, so when you look at University of Paris and all those old universities, they were all created on the 1200s, were exactly during this period, but it led to, it created the campus of the university, the campi, the humanities, which was Plato, and the science, where the physics, which was Aristotle, taught, and that's why physicians, until today, the, you know, you can see the problems of humanities and the College of Arts and Sciences in the campus. It comes straight from that division of Platonic and Aristotelic thought. However, the Aristotelic movement, it through the Organon, it had all that inductive thought that led to the so-called dogmatic scholasticism that in the year 1500s start crashing down, and that's when then Francis Bacon came with the new Organon. Why the new Organon? The old Organon was the Aristotle's Organon, which was the way of thinking about nature by the inductive method that many people thought was a waste of time, but it lasted 500 years or 400 years. And you look at even the preface of the new Organon, those who have taken upon them to lay down the law of nature as a thing already searched out and understood, like the dogmaticism, they would already know everything. Whether they have spoken in simple assurance or professional affectation, a lot of us just want to show off like I'm doing here, have their done philosophy and the sciences great injury. So then he starts then initially already attacking that whole dogmaticism. And actually, I'm reading right now David Hume's treatise on human nature, and he starts very similarly. Okay, so in that new period then, Newton and all the Enlightenment sciences came through to what we know today. I think that the only single big advance in this period was the Thomas Kuhn book in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions that shows that we have paradigms that change one paradigm over the other, but still the methodology remains the same. This is not the case with scientific revelations. So how do we go through scientific revelation? So everything that I'm doing in the lab now starts from interpreting the genome or transcriptome. It's not from creating a hypothesis from something that is out there. But from these readings, Baconian experiments are designed. And so first I have hypothesis and experiment results, and then these results will feed me to do another hypothesis. Or I then just throw away the whole thing and start it from scratch when there is a paradigm. Now I read the genome, and then there is something between here that then I create a hypothesis and I go around that. So how do I read the genome? Do I need algorithms to identify the words of what is the meaning and devices needed to check temporal, spatial expression of those? So going back to my model then, of going back to 900 years to Maimonides, I mean, the interpretation of the book led to the Kabbalah movement, which actually I showed the picture of Isaac Newton. His last days were trying to use like prime numbers as a function to read each letter of the Bible in Hebrew and see if there is a second reading of that. So, and you see here that there are programs that you can get Exodus 3.8 and try to find an algorithm to get a second reading, which may be needed. So, and to me, you find that the same place. So this is Artemis. You have the whole genome here, and you have a whole Kabbalah that you can extract the information from the, so it's, you have to find Kabbalahs, which are algorithms to interpret. And then there is another thing that I can also go to biblical times. The supreme sacerdote that would be priest that would be in front of the Ark of the Covenant, he had these 12 gems that represent the 12 tribes. And if there was a question like, should we attack these people or not attack these people? So the priest would go in front of the Ark and look at his chest and look for reflections. And according to the reflections of the gems, he would get what to do. So that's a lot. So this is what I call divination. So it's the second process that we have. So we have the genome, and we have Kabbalah and divination. And and after that, we can create hypotheses and go down there. So we have now two different systems in biological research, the traditional and the genomic. The hypothesis-driven produces knowledge driven by R01s, and the genomic is genome information produces hypotheses. That's the output, because you cannot get anything else out of it. And it's driven by, I don't know exactly what, there are some grants of NIH, but then it's very confusing, because the traditional way is done by scientists at multiple research institutions. The genomic, it tends to be like, have the NCBI or the SCORE institutes. They are at centralized genomic centers. They look to me more like oracles. It's like the Delphi Oracle. You go there and say, tell me, can you find me this or that? And so I do a bit of bioinformatics, so people come to me, it's like coming to an oracle. Can you find the answer to this? So how is research, genomic research being funded, and how genomes are going to be kept, maintained, and curated in the long term? One problem that I find is that this is what Colin Powell said, you sequence it, you own it. So like people sequence the Anopheles gandhi genome, and then they move to another genome, and it's only a draft. It's not ready yet. So who is gonna take care of that? And the genome is very poorly annotated, so we're gonna move to another one, to another. Who is gonna pay for that? I actually have a formula also that was invented by the Jews, because to keep the information of the people, they eventually selected one of the 12 tribes to keep the information. And so I think 1/12 of the budget of NIH should be given to maintaining the genomes. I think it's a formula, because it's basically maintaining information. So everything that I am actually finding, that everything that is metaphysical could be transformed into the world informational. We have a you know, a physical world and an informational world, and not metaphysical. So transcriptomes, arrays, curation, you know, VectorDB got all these millions of dollars for doing it. And then what about 10 years, 20 years from now? How is it going to be? The problem also that I feel, you know, if I see, I am on the study section of the vector biology, we see grants arriving there, and this is what these grants look like for the majority of the people in the study section. They look like a genomic research fishing expedition. There's no hypothesis driven. Well, Maimonides also in his book says that there are four reasons you cannot learn new things. One, we may not be intelligent enough, we may not have previous knowledge of the subject, we may be intelligent and previous knowledge, but it may be a very hard nut to crack. And we may be in the habit of seeing things differently. We may just have the habit, we just don't get it. And that's the impression I have on my colleagues many times in the study section. They just don't get it, that we are in a new way. And a thing that I think it's missing now, I like a lot, this is Raphael's, This was painted in the 1500s. You see here Plato pointing to the skies and Aristotle pointing to the ground. In this corner here, this is the School of Alexandria with down here is Euclides. And a great poet of the Enlightenment, which is William Blake, he just painted hundreds of, this is his view of Isaac Newton as somebody from the new times. So you can see the parallel that he did between the two schools and the new times. But we don't have an equivalent to describe to us with this massive amount of information that we have today in everything, even falling credit cards, you know, cell phones, and all this informational world that we have now. We don't have a new organon to deal with that. We don't have proper appraisal of that. And this is, I think, our postmodernist phase. Now, I still have some time, and I'll go to a second part that is to describe some of my Tikk Kabbalah. I don't know if I should take questions on that part now or maybe just move. What I have been doing a lot lately is to do transcriptomes of blood-sucking arthropods, and one thing that we find is because blood-feeding mode evolved independently in many families and orders, all these insects and ticks, they had to discover things independently from each other. And they create either recruited families that are completely different from each other to do the same function. For example, you find always a pyrase activity, which is that breaks down ATP and ADP, because ADP and ATP released during breakdown of cells is very potent inflammatory substance. It induces platelet aggregation, neutrophil aggregation, so on. So most blood-sucking arthropods invented a pyrase in the saliva, but it can be 5' nucleotidase, it can be CD39, it can be a completely novel enzyme that we discovered in bed bugs and so on. And sometimes the other thing we know also is that the salivary gland proteins evolve at a very fast pace, and that's the reason that maybe many times we find completely novel protein families in the salivary gland. So one of the things that we did recently, this is a book chapter that two of the editors are here in the room, and that is, I guess it's out, or it's out. And we wrote the role of saliva in tick feeding. We had a good discussion of the problems that tick face taking a blood meal, and all the blood coagulation cascade, and the tick and immunity, and overview. But we also try to describe, since I do a lot of my papers, I call the sialom, you know, sialo, saliva. But now we're trying to go to another word, toward the sialoverse. So like the universe of salivary proteins in all for the tick. I actually preparing a paper on the sialoverse of the nematocera, the blood-feeding nematocera. So And then you can see the different protein families that are listed here, just families containing protease inhibitor domains and lipocalins. There are enormous number of lipocalins, enzymes. You know, I have here just as one entry, but there are several, I mean, phospholipases, metalloprotease, and you name it. Immunity-related, saliva has always a lot of antimicrobial activity associated with that. And there are many metastriate-specific families, prostriate-specific families, argasid-specific families, and so on. What I did is that I downloaded all the ESTs from the best, including, I'm afraid, some of the papers that are not still published, but I don't feel very bad because I'm not writing a paper, I'm writing a review. So I'm writing a review about the papers that are going to be published, but I don't feel bad. And I did not submit any open reading frame to the to GenBank or anything, but it's all here. Basically, what I did then is that I extracted, I pipe all this information into Excel spreadsheet. And then here you can see, like, for example, the glycine-rich superfamily, and then we found what is probably cuticle proteins. And this spreadsheet is all hyperlinked. You have, you know, the signal P results best match to the non-redundant database and so on. So you click there for the signal P, you can see the results of the signal P. You can look, for instance, evasin, which is a protein that is was discovered to have immune function, and then you find all the evasins, which are down here. You can find with Steven Weichel's Derma Center, Andersoni, P36 immunosuppressant family, and you see here we find in Derma Center, Andersoni, here is in Amblyomma variegatum, Derma Center, Andersoni, Rippicephalus appendiculatus, and all that. With all the information, you can see here the best match to the nucleotide, the non-redundant nucleotide database. You click there, you get all the results. Another thing that I do that helps a lot the classification of these spreadsheets is that I clusterize the protein sequences by a Cyblast. I do a Cyblast of each protein against itself, against all the others, and I see what pulls back after 5 interactions. So in some cases, it gives like just too many results, but in this case, you see that it pulled out the 22 proteins, and then you can go and see that you have all these amblyomma and Derma Center proteins. You have already the alignments, oops, I'm sorry. And you can clusterize them by 30% similarity over 50% of length, or 40%, 35% similarity, and so you have GIF, so you can see almost like the tree of similarities among them. This way you can, like for instance, the evasins, you don't find them on the, only one in Ixodes capillaries, but it's not a multiple. You can see that this Amblyomma americanum, there are two of them, we found one in Cajanensis as well. It's very common that you find a lot of gene duplications. Bottom line, then, on salivary proteins, there are hundreds of proteins in dozens of families. Usually a mosquito has 70 to 100 different proteins in the cyalome. There is lots of prostriate or metastriate specific families, and you can, browsing that data, that spreadsheet, you can see them. Most of them, like 90% of them, are unknown function. And I actually calculated that if each genus that we describe, we find at least 2 to 5 proteins that are new, novel, you don't find in any other. So if it takes like 1.5 years for each of these proteins to be described and found a function, and if there are 500 different genera, we're talking about thousands of years of research just to get the specific ones. But in the case of ticks, there are hundreds. So there are at least 5,000 years of research to be done to describe these proteins. So now I'm going to get on my last part, and I think I'm going to have some time for discussion. There is a release of the Ixodes capillaries, it's called version 0.5. When we had the Anopheles gambia genome, that was our first genome, the genome came, you know, one sequence for the 2L, the chromosome 2L, 2R, 3L, 3L, 3R, 3L, and X chromosome, and then the Y chromosome. So we had six sequences, DNA sequences. The Exodus capillaris has 360,000 sequences. And one of the reasons is that you cannot assemble all that because there is so many repeats in the gunshot sequences. So there are, unfortunately, only 184,000 ESTs. Like Aedes aegypti had a nearly 500,000, and Gambia has about 380,000. But I assembled these 184,000 ESTs and compared these ESTs to the genome and to the gene predictions. So my grades are C plus, B minus for the genome, and F for the gene predictions. And I'm going to explain why. And of course, this is version 0.5. This is still being worked. This data is with Vish, and he's saying that it's been very useful. So these 180 ESTs were assembled, and you can see, for instance, what the assembly is. You can see that, and these are the DBEST numbers, accession numbers. And I also, I don't know who made the Syngangrium library, but I can, for instance, if there is, like this here has 10 ESTs on this on the pool libraries and one on the Syngangria with a total of 11. And then I had also made chi-squares for everything. So you can immediately pick up what is increased or decreased depending on the library that you study. I had also my salivary glands and all this. I am not doing any of the analysis of this for Syngangria or anything, but the data is there. So whoever is writing this paper, go there. Because you can find it, from these ESTs, I annotated 4,098 CDSs. You know, so like here, you see the best match to the assembled EST database. Not all of them are full. You see here 5' truncated full, 5' truncated full. If it has a stop codon, so I can see which ones, but about 3/4 of them are full-length things. And I also I annotated them with a meaningful names based on the COG or SwissProt or non-redundant database. And here I have exons found and linked to the data. So you see here that this is the whole sequence. And then you see here that is a scaffold, and it is getting, you know, one exon on this scaffold. So right there you see that it's missing the first part of the sequence. And then so you see the scaffold here, and then there is another scaffold that is picking up at the 547 to 255, and it is, so it is, there are exons missing here. And from this I created a table that I sent to Vish and the people that are assembling, because when you read the genome and then you see, am I finding my exons in the scaffold, 67% are correct. So there is, you know, another 33% that are sometimes you find in the scaffold one exon, the other exon, but the exon in the middle is missing. So it was really assembled wrong. So there is that. But when I'm reading the protein predictions, only 37% of them agree. There is lots of proteins there that are missing exons, that are missing a lot of things. So that's why I gave a, you know, a B minus C plus here, and you know here I think it's an F. I mean, I wouldn't. So there is a need of a quite a bit some more of a work on this. These data sets. If you send me an email to the email is here. I can send you the link. We have a NAID web server, and you can just download the whole data. And you don't need any SQL server and anybody in Unix. And you can run this all in your PC, and no problem. And I'll take questions from here. I think we have some time for it.
Functional studies are of course, and
Well, in my lab, I did just the part of more of the bioinformatics of the genome part. What we are doing is very arbitrarily, in my case, we are taking proteins to be expressed. And one machine that we have now that is incredibly good for this is the BioCore machine. Unfortunately, it's an expensive machine, but everything that is on saliva, it's either an antimicrobial or is interacting with something on the host. So basically, the BioCore machine is based on plasmon surface resonance. You bind your protein on a chip, and so the protein is there on the chip, and then you have a laser that hits the chip, and then the laser reflects on that chip. But when the laser, the photons are doing that interaction with the substrate and reflecting, they actually, it goes into one of those, you know, twilight zones, because it's not photon, it's not, you can imagine the photon as having sensing all the electromagnets that are on there, and then that is incorporated on, and that's the plasmon. The plasmon is this photon that is interacting with everything, and then it reflects. And based on that electromagnetic interaction, it may shift a little bit the phase. Now you go with a molecule that binds to that molecule on the top, and now you have changes on the masses that are associated with that interface. So when the laser hits there and reflects, it will change the angle or the phase, and you can read that. So, and actually you can flow, and then you can see the binding, and then when you remove the flow, you can see the K-off. You can measure actually biological, you know, physical chemical constants about that. And many times you can just pass, you don't need a pure thing that you pass through. You have the pure thing on the chip, and then you can pass plasma through it. And then you can start fractionating plasma to find what it is, or you can find other proteins. So we are finding lots of activities like that by pure, you know, it has nothing to do with hypothesis-driven research. After you write, you have that to say, a lot of proteins on the stick saliva must interact with matrix proteins and this and that, and then we test it. Then you invent something to write it down, but it has nothing to do with hypothesis-driven research as well. So that's why I say we need some basis for that. The other thing is, of course, is using arrays. We have just had the first result of an array that we spotted all the 8,000 ESTs from the salivary glands, and we are seeing now as the tick feeds how these things light up and down. And because there are many protein families, and we already know from a few of them, for instance, cystatins that are inhibitors of cysteine proteases, that, you know, one is very high the 0 day and then goes down, and then by the third day the other goes up. So there, I think there is a way to evade immunity by doing that. So you are standing up at my time?
No?
Okay.
You mentioned something that concerns most of us in this room about the NIHR1 hypothesis driven versus
research.
Is that a fear on the vector biology study section panel where people are actually being educated about tick resistance? One of the problems that first, basically, the question I get is, you're not showing that this is important to human health.
There are two, in the last study section, I had a lot of fights there, because there is one thing now that they have is significance to public health.
Yes.
And then you have seen people doing, you know, really convolutions of rhetoric to try to explain that you are doing some genome that will help for some transgenic mosquito. You know, you cannot use science or knowledge basis as an important thing for NIH anymore because of this significance. I can see where that comes from, because it comes from the Senate, basically, or the House. Because the House is like, views the scientists like the Simpsons. You know, all this stupid. I don't care how many papers you have published this year. You know, I want to know vaccines and this. And then, for example, intramural NIH increased fivefold the number of people in tech transfer, and they want us to patent everything. I know that it's never going to make it to the field, but they want us to patent because that's what they want to hear, how many patents. And it's almost like, excuse me, you should ask the pharmaceutical industry how NIH research is helping them to find the medicine. We are not in a socialist state that we have a monopoly of the pharmaceutical company. You know, the research, the output of research is knowledge. Technology brings knowledge to things, so they are asking to NIH what technology we are bringing. And the problem is that instead of us trying to educate, if that is the word, to what research means, we are trying to give them what they want. So it's the vaccine, this, and now the grants are becoming the worst of all. NSF, I received an email from NSF that they're saying that they are very proud that they are changing their things, and then that they are going to have to include translationability into one of the evaluation criteria for grants on NSF. NSF, the last bastion of research, of pure research. So I don't know where this is going. And this issue of significance, if you, one thing that I bet in this last study section, there were a number of grants that I was saying, we don't, what if the significance is for the advancement of the knowledge basis? Because we don't know what in 10 years is gonna be. Like, the guy that was doing fluorescent protein, the green fluorescent protein that got the Nobel Prize, I mean, he could have got the Golden Fleece Award, you know, for making protein to bright in the 12 years ago. So how do one knows what is the... So I'm very frustrated. I was almost quitting, and then I said, that's not the right thing to do, you know, I'm going to be there just... I want to be fired if I am, but not quit, but I'm going not to keep my mouth shut there. So, but I don't know. It's sad to see. And to the point that I ask my colleague, don't you want to see research done? Yes, but I don't agree with the significance. I don't agree with that. It's like we are correcting term papers, you know, to see. So we are back to the academic, to the scholastic dogmaticism, you know, in one way. I'm very frustrated about that.
I think that's a very big thing to take research. You have to demonstrate almost, how do you know this is important to humans? Well, that's a very tough question to answer, knowing that the people on the study panel, they are in life science, I'm sure.
Jesse, after comparing all those in that data, which is in the database, did you see any kind of conserved molecules which are conserved across the whole species, like embryoma, exergy, and optimized?
Well, two metalloproteases, which are, I think are important for creating the feeding lesion. It's in all of them. And then the recruitment of the Kunitz family, you have dozens, you know, more than, because many times it's difficult because I don't know what is an allele and what is a real gene, but you have hundreds of different proteins, but probably in more than 50 genes that are different genes with single Kunitz, dual Kunitz, five Kunitz, some of which we have characterized, but a lot of them not. So these are lipocalins. We just described lipocalins that bind LTB4 and that bind leukotrienes and that bind thromboxane. And I imagine that there is a lot more, and probably on adenosine as well and things like that. So, and that's very unique to ticks. But for instance, like mosquitoes, they don't have a single Kunitz domain in their spitome. They have, some of them have serpents like the Culex and the Gambia. Anopheles invented a completely new one. But you get into black flies, we are publishing one of black flies, they are full of Kunitz. So I think that's one of the, Kunitz is a typical fold that is exists throughout animals and vegetables that is typically a proteinase inhibitor. Yes, you have then these gene duplications, and many times when you do the phylogeny, you can see that the two you can see both like branchings. So you see that there are local, I don't know if there are recent duplications or if there is gene conversion among them. And then sometimes you can see that you have these two very close from different two ticks. So they are really the orthologs, but then the others, like the D7 proteins in mosquitoes, they do that. They have three large ones and five small ones, and then you can see that you have these pairs, the orthologs come nicely, but sometimes not. Sometimes you can see really this branching. Actually, this is one interesting thing because you see mosquitoes have three pairs of chromosomes. Ticks have more than 20. So one of the aspects is whether ticks evolved by genome duplication, just like if it looks like the mammals, the vertebrates, when you have the without jaws, the fish without jaws, you have a jump on the number of chromosomes after that. And so ticks may have evolved by genome duplication, by two, three, or more genome duplication. And that immediately creates the issue of you having more of it. If that increased number of genes is helpful by increasing the dose of expression in some particular organ, which I imagine was the salivary glands, because you're just increasing more the gene expression in the saliva, then you can have, after the gene duplication, you can have divergence of function. And you find those many pairs. And in the mosquitoes, you can find that most of these gene families, they are all tandem repeats. They may have a role in that format. In ticks, I'm finding lots of genes that are single exonic in the chromosome, or in the scaffolds, and in many times you can see a poly A on the genome. So you can see that there is probably a lot of retrotransposition events as a mechanism of gene duplication. And that may explain the huge genome. I think maybe the whole idea of having lots of active transposable elements have been very creative in the tick. And then in this case, probably we're not going to see many tandem duplications. We're going to see just duplications in many places. I name them, for example, many times they have like a PNP, like that aligns within that family, so then I call the PNP family, because when I see a blast, I can see, but many times I just give the probable molecular weight of the 23.6 kilodalton family, or this, because